This is a Saturday Night Live speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on August 13, 1999. Our speaker is Coco L. of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
That's my posse over there. I'm Coco and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm still a two-fisted drinker. Some things never change. Still very indecisive. I don't know what I'm going to want tonight. So, let's see. I'm a little nervous, but I think that's to be expected. It's my very first speaker meeting, and a friend of mine told me that, you know, I was going to be launching my circuit speaker career here tonight. So you should all remember this night. It's going to be a very important one. You know, I have a few fears, and I was told as soon as I came into the program that you will be as sick as your secrets. And so I try to share all my secrets. So I'm going to tell you what I'm afraid of tonight. I'm going to just get that out of the way so I can go ahead and tell my story. One of my fears tonight is that I'm going to choke. That I'm literally going to start choking and coughing. And so, you know, I figured, well, maybe I can ask a favor. If I start choking, if you would all just start coughing with me, then I won't feel so bad. So maybe we could practice. Okay, good. All right, got that one out of the way. The other fear that I have is that I'm going to crap my pants. And I won't ask you to participate if that happens. And the third fear is that I'm going to talk too long. And I'm sure Steve will let me know when my time is up. So anyway, those are my fears. And if those things don't happen, then I will consider this night a success. You know, I'm going to tell you what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like now. And I think it's really important that you know a little bit about how I was raised and how I grew up. I'm just going to tell you that I'm one of three daughters. I'm the middle daughter. And that's right, the favorite. I saw someone go like this. Yes, middle daughter's usually the favorite. And I had a very normal childhood. I had two parents. We had a house with a white picket fence and, you know, just a very normal upbringing. We were not a religious family. My parents said that if you choose to practice some religion, we'll be happy to drive you to any church you'd like. You know, there wasn't a lot of pressure put on us as far as having to believe a certain way. We were raised, us three girls were raised with a lot of morals and values and a lot of rules that I didn't agree with. But, you know, it was a very nice upbringing. And the only thing that I felt as a child that is probably not atypical is that I felt I suffered from middle child syndrome. And if you're a middle child, you know what I'm talking about. But if you're not a middle child, I will explain, especially since my younger sibling is here, and she probably doesn't understand. But I remember growing up often asking my parents for things or permission to do things, and they would say, no, you can't have that. Your older sister's going to get that because she's the oldest. She's the oldest, so she gets that. And on the other hand, I heard oftentimes that, you know, well, she's the baby, let her have it. You know, I felt like I was screaming, well, I'm in the middle, you know, what about me? But, you know, that was probably just my perception. One thing I've learned since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is that my perception is very warped, that I see things in a very self-centered way. And I think that started as a very young child. I believe that I was born with the disease of alcoholism. I believe that it is genetic. And I believe that alcoholism is not only a physical allergy to alcohol, where you're allergic to alcohol and, you know, you have this mental obsession to drink, but I think that the disease of alcoholism affects the way that we think. I forgot to say something to start off the meeting, and that is I want to welcome Marlena and Patty and Mary and Autumn and Hamid, our newcomers tonight. This meeting's for you. You know, this is, I hope that you hear something tonight that you'll take home with you, and I hope that you don't have to drink one day at a time. I'd also like to welcome Kevin back there. Where'd he go? Oh, he left. No, there he is. Kevin, welcome back. Good to see you. I didn't boo. It was all of them. So anyway, you know, I had a very normal upbringing, and I went through, you know, toddlerhood and childhood and elementary school. In elementary school, I admired my teachers, and I loved my teachers, and I wanted to be a teacher, and I played school until I was 13 years old. I just loved pretending, and yeah, that went on a little long, I guess. Yeah. But that's who I was, and I felt comfortable with who I was. And then I went into high school, and I think it was my freshman or sophomore year of high school, I hadn't drank or hadn't used drugs or anything. And my younger sibling, the one that I'll probably mention a few times tonight, Emily, introduced me to marijuana. And she said, "Hey, you want to smoke some stuff?" And I said, "Well, God, what is that? You know, Mom and Dad are going to kill us." And she said, "Oh, they don't have to know. You know, you spray some perfume and pop a breath mint and you feel really good. Just try it." So I did. And it was a wonderful experience. And we spent that whole summer, I think you were in 8th grade and I was in 10th grade or something. We spent that whole summer going to Mary Jane Hammond Park. We used to call it Marijuana Hammond Park. And getting loaded. And it was a great summer. It was just great. Really enjoyed myself. And also that same year when I started my sophomore year of high school, I was introduced by some friends that I was hanging out with to alcohol, to booze. I would go to parties on the weekends, on Friday and Saturday night, high school parties, and they were called keggers. You know, who's having a kegger this weekend? And I would go to the parties, and I would get smashed. I would drink so much booze that I would black out. I was a blackout drinker. And I remember thinking that it was no problem for a long, long time. That, you know, you go to parties, you drink, you get smashed, you black out. You know, you wake up the next day and you find out where the party's going to be the next night. No big deal. And one time after going to a Saturday night kegger party and blacking out once again, there was this, I remember there was this guy, there was this big, tall, dark, kind of creepy-looking drug dealer guy. And his name was Marlone. And then I went to the party that Saturday night. I remember partying with Marlone and smoking joints and staying right by the keg and drinking. And the next Monday, I went back to school. And as I was walking down the hallways, people were saying, "Hey, Carlone, how's it going?" And I'm going, "What? You know, why are people calling me Carlone? I don't understand." So I asked my friends, and my friends said, "Well, don't you remember?" And I said, "I don't think I want to." And, you know, apparently I was with Marlone that night. And it was kind of at that moment that I thought, you know, there's probably something wrong with the way I drink. Because I know that if I wasn't drunk and in a blackout, I know that I would not have been with Marlone. So I had just a little inkling that something was, you know, not right. But it certainly didn't stop me from going to parties and continuing to drink and get loaded. And I continued doing that through high school. I also, enjoyed a line here or there, and of course, because of my addiction brought on by Emily, I was heavily into marijuana, and I'm not sure if you're the one that introduced me to chili cheese corn dogs from Wiener Schnitzel when you're stoned, but that I was grateful for. Those things are good when you're stoned. Anyway, I quite enjoyed my drinking through high school. And then I graduated from high school, and I continued to drink and party. And my parents, of course, raising us with good morals and values, wanted me to go on to college. And so, to please my parents, for their sake, I enrolled in college. And I went to a junior college for a couple of quarters and really didn't attend class or take notes or, pay attention to lectures or do my homework or anything like that. What I was interested in were these college parties, the college kegger parties. And so I partied my way through a couple of quarters at De Anza, and I happened to hook up with somebody through a job that I had who could get me into San Jose State University before finishing my AA degree. That would not be an Alcoholics Anonymous degree. That would be an Associate of Arts degree. And So I somehow weaseled my way into San Jose State University, and I didn't have the grades to be there, and I didn't have, the desire to learn or anything like that, but a connection of mine at work got me into San Jose State University. And again, at San Jose State University, I was there, I don't remember, one or two semesters. I think I was there two semesters. It was mostly a blackout. I don't remember a lot of it, but what I do remember is at the end of the end of the semester that I was there, the officials at San Jose State University told me to leave and to not come back, that you are officially ejected from college, from San Jose State University. So expelled is the word. I guess not ejected. That officially expelled from college. And again, it was a result of my drinking. I was so interested in partying and staying up all night and doing lines and going to concerts and going to parties and being with different guys and just, I was really into the party scene, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I hadn't gotten, besides the Marlone incident, I hadn't gotten into too much trouble by that time. So I, was expelled from San Jose State and quite relieved, actually. I didn't want to be there in the first place. So I was quite relieved. I don't think I told my parents I was expelled. I think I told them that I had chosen to not continue my college education. And what happened is I went into the working world. I got a job in the high-tech industry, the Silicon Valley sales. I became a sales representative for a semiconductor manufacturing company. And what happened for me is I started making a lot of money. And I was able to get my own apartment, buy a new nice car, buy some nice clothes, get myself a little dog, get the nice furniture for the apartment, and kind of sort of set up house. And I felt like I was really grown up. In a way, I felt like I was really grown up. In another way, I felt like I was a big loser, because this is how my day went. I would get up in the morning, every morning, really, really, really hungover. Really hungover, and I would be sick to my stomach, and I'd have a horrible headache. I was a wine drinker, and I don't know if you've ever had, like, a wine hangover, but it's just horrible. I don't ever want to forget that feeling, because I don't ever want to have it again. But I would get up with this horrendous hangover, and I would tell myself, I am not going to drink today. Oh my gosh, I do not want to wake up another morning feeling like this. And so I would get dressed, my nice business suit, and grab my briefcase and, go down the elevator from my penthouse apartment to my nice little car, and and get in the car and drive to work, and I'd get to work, and I'd make some sales calls, do some paperwork, and usually about by 11 or 11:30 in the morning, I was feeling much better. You know, usually I'd had some kind of a breakfast or, you know, I don't know, a Togo sandwich or something, fill that old hole, and, you know, and the headache was gone, and the nausea was gone, and I was thinking I was feeling pretty good and doing pretty good. And I would start thinking about my drinking for the evening. And I had to think about it because, you see, when I say I was a wine drinker, I don't mean I drank these beautiful bottles of wine, you know, with the pretty labels and, you know, had a couple glasses of wine. I went for either the boxes or those big, I don't know, they're like 2-gallon jugs, you know. And of E and J, I think it was, Ernest and Julio, my two best friends at the time. I went for the big jugs, and I knew that there was something not right with me. I knew that there was something not right about going home and drinking 2 gallons of wine a night. That was not normal. And so because I knew it was not normal, I felt that I had to not let the clerks at the liquor store see my pattern. So each night of the week I went to a different liquor store because I didn't want, you know, the guy at 7-Eleven to see me, you know, 7 nights in a row buying 2 gallons of wine. You know, he might think that I have a problem, and I wouldn't want the 7-Eleven clerk to think that I had a problem. So I go to 7-Eleven on one night, and then I go to this liquor store on another night, and different liquor store on another night. And so by 11:30 in the morning, when my head's starting to clear and I'm starting to feel better, I had to think, okay, where did I go last night for my booze? Have I been to that store for a while? You know, I had to really kind of figure out where I was. And so I would start thinking about it, and I would go to the store and I'd buy my 2 gallons of wine, and I wanted to try and have a balanced diet because of all this drinking I was doing, so I'd buy some beef jerky for some protein and usually a bag of chips because I knew I needed some carbohydrates. So, and occasionally some fruit gum, like some juicy fruit because I have fruit in it, right? So I'd take my dinner and my wine and I'd take it home. And I would drink, and I would drink, and I would drink, and I'd just sit there until the 2 gallons were almost gone, until I passed out, basically. And I remember waking up a couple of mornings just drenched in, I don't know, body fluids. Just drenched. And thinking, God, how did I live? How did I live through the night? I don't know. I remember another time I had conveniently broken my leg as a result of drinking, and so I was on crutches for a while, and I remember it was a real hassle to go get that big jug of wine and all of my dinner with crutches. That was a real hassle. And I remember one time getting all the way from the liquor store with my bag of stuff. You know, I had the plastic bags with the loop, you know, thing on my arm, and I've got both my crutches, and I'm limping, and I get all the way up to the top floor to my apartment, and I'm unlocking the door, and the bag breaks, and the wine bottle breaks, and it shatters. And you know what? I turned right back around, went back to the store, and got it again. I mean, I was, you know, I didn't feel like I was a whole person unless I, you know, had my booze. Something to fill that hole, something to, you know, fill my head, because I didn't like who I was. Really, that was the truth. On the outside, by all outside appearances, you know, people thought I had my stuff together. You know, I've got this great job, I've got my own place, I'm only 21 years old. You know, life is happening, and the truth of the matter is that I would go home with my jug of wine every night, turn on my answering machine, deadbolt my door, close the curtains, and you know, it'd be me and my dog, and I would see people, you know, leaving to go to the gym to work out or working in their, you know, on their plants, on their patio, doing some gardening, or, you know, coming back with shopping bags from the mall and stuff. I would see people living these so-called normal lives, and I would think, what is wrong with me? Why am I not out there doing living life like everybody else is living life? I remember doing some horrible things to my family. It was my mother's birthday one time, and I had gone to the Gilroy Garlic Festival and it had gotten completely smashed, and it was her birthday, and it was her birthday party that day, and I knew that I had to be at her house at a certain time, and I hadn't gotten a gift yet. And I, you know, I bought her a $2 pot holder from the Gilroy Garlic Festival. And, you know, she didn't appreciate that. You know, not that she's into material things or anything, but she knew what was going on. She knew I was loaded. And I know I broke her heart many times over. So my drinking progressed. You know, occasionally I would get out of my apartment. I had a couple of friends left by that time. I pretty much lost contact with any friends that I had from college or high school because I was so isolated. And occasionally I would get out. As a matter of fact, one of the last times I saw one of my drinking friends, we were driving down Highway 101, possibly even coming back from the Gilroy Garlic Festival, and she was driving, and I remember her shirt was on fire. And all I remember is wanting to get out of that car because something wasn't right. You know? And I never saw her again. You know, I probably told her to pull over and let me out and see if she's on fire. You know, I don't know. But, you know, those are the kinds of relationships that I had when I was out there. My drinking did progress. And like I said, I did get out once in a while. And I would do things like go check into the Motel 6 over in Milpitas, get my 2-gallon jug of wine. Okay, this is a night out for me, okay? And then get in my car and drive maybe one or two blocks down to the Hilton in Milpitas and sit there at the bar hoping to find some white knight in shining armor to, you know, fix me. And so I checked in the Motel 6 and had my 2-gallon jug of wine just in case I didn't meet him at the bar, and drove a couple blocks to the Hilton, sitting in the Hilton, you know, looking all hotty-totty. And, you know, he never came along. Either, maybe he did, but he probably looked at me and went, loser, or, you know, I don't know. But he never came along. And so I was a little depressed and a little drunk, and so I got back in my car, and I blacked out. Even though I only had a distance of about 2 blocks to go back to my Motel 6 room, I don't know how it happened. You know, again, it was a blackout. This is what I remember coming to. I remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, it is so cold in my car, so cold in here. And I leaned over to roll up the window because I felt this draft, and I had no door on my car. The left side of my car was gone. I was on rims. I had two metal rims on the left side of my car, and I have no idea what happened. I don't know what I hit, who I hit. This is how I came out of a blackout. And somebody must have seen me driving. This was on 237. Someone must have seen me driving because as I pulled off the next exit ramp, because I figured, you know, I'm going like 19 miles an hour on the freeway with on two rims and half a car. And I figured I better exit. So as I'm exiting the freeway, you know, here are these cops that are like merging on this exit. So I assume that somebody way back then had a cell phone and they probably saw me and alerted the police department. And I was arrested that night. And it was actually my second DUI. My first DUI had happened about 6.5 years earlier. And it was actually dropped to a wet reckless, little slap on the hand, and I thought, oh, you know, this is no big deal. But because I was arrested again that night for a DUI, it was considered my second offense. And I remember being in the back of that cop car, and as they were taking me to Camp Elmwood, we passed that Motel 6. And I said, can you just drop me off? I'm just right there, you know. And what I'm thinking is, I just want to grab my jug of wine because I'm not going to make it through the night. So I spent the night in jail. And what happened is about, you know, 4 or 5 weeks later, had to go to court. And the judge told me that he thought I had a problem drinking. and that not only was he going to suspend my license, send me to jail, make me go to drunk driving school, but he was also requesting that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was okay with the suspended license because I knew I'd still drive anyway. And, you know, the jail time, you know, I figured I might be able to get out of it somehow. And the drunk driving school, I thought that they were going to teach me how to drive drunk. So I thought that might be actually a good thing to know. But the AA, you know, I thought, what the hell is that? You know, if I have to go to AA meetings, when am I going to drink? You know, he told me I had to go to 60 meetings in 90 days and be back in his courtroom on the 91st day and show him proof that I had been going to AA. And I was a little upset at that. And I put it off, you know, I put it off for some time. I continued drinking. And finally, one morning after I came out of a sort of a blackout, and actually what had happened the night before is I was on a date with this really nice guy, a teacher. You know how I feel about teaching. I was on a date with this teacher, and I just thought, oh, he's something else. Anyway, I went into a blackout on this date, and I don't know what I did. I have no idea, but he called my mother to come get me. Now, I'm 26 years old. Talk about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, the odd thing is that I sometimes see that teacher in this room today, and I think, hey, how you doing? What did I do that night that I haven't asked yet? I figure either he owes me an amends, I owe him an amends, or it's just God's will. So my mother had to come and pick me up from this date, and the next morning she said to me, you know, don't you think it's time you start going to those AA meetings? And I said, oh, God, maybe. Okay, yeah, things are getting pretty bad. So I called the central office, and they told me about a place called Saturday Night Live. And this was when it was located over in the old El Paseo de Saratoga, in the back there behind Safeway. And I came to my first meeting on a Sunday, and I can't remember the time of the meeting. Maybe 2:00 or something like that. And what I heard at that meeting was the same kind of stories of things that had happened to me. You know, the drunk drivings and the waking up after a blackout, not knowing what you did, not knowing where your car was, not knowing who is that man next to me. You know, I don't recognize this ceiling. You know, I heard those kinds of things from other people, and I was shocked. I was really shocked. I thought, I can't believe there are other people out there that have had these experiences. And I was quite relieved, actually, because not only did they tell me and share with me some of those horrible stories, which we now find amusing, but they also told me that one day at a time, they didn't have to drink anymore if they chose not to. And I thought, wow, that's really incredible. They're not drinking anymore. So I stuck around. I went to that meeting, and then there was a women's meeting at 4:30 that afternoon. That's when the women's meetings were, at 4:30 on Sundays. And I stayed at the women's meeting, and I heard even more great stuff at the women's meetings. And then I realized that someone told me to stick around. There's a meeting at 7:30. So I stayed for the 7:30 meeting. So I had gone to 3 meetings that day. And, of course, because of my suspended license, you know, I had to call my mom. Hey, Mom, can you come get me from the meeting? Okay, thanks, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's my boyfriend. He's coming to pick me up. Yeah, okay. So my mom came to pick me up, and she said, well, how was it? You were gone a long time. And I said, you know what, Mom? I'm an alcoholic. And she said, oh, no, really? Really? Wow. I said, yeah, isn't that great? And she's like, okay, sure, yeah, that's wonderful. I was elated, truly. I had never been so relieved in my life. I was so relieved that finally I knew what was wrong with me. Because like I said before, I always knew there was something wrong with what I was doing, and I just didn't know what it was. And finally, I had a name for my condition. And not only did I have a name, but I also heard there was a solution. I was just elated. And as a matter of fact, I went around, you know, kind of wanting to shout it to the, you know, world. Hey, I'm an alcoholic! Isn't that great? You know, but some of you suggested to me that it's sometimes better to keep your anonymity. That, you know, in certain situations, you may wish to tell somebody, you know, your situation. But outside of these rooms, it's, you know, sometimes best to keep your anonymity. So I thought, well, whatever. Okay. I'll do what they suggest, because that's what I heard. I heard that if you do a few simple things that are suggested around here, that you too can stay sober. And they suggested that I not go shout it to the world. As a matter of fact, I was out one night. I had asked my friend, Mary Ann, I said, you know, I'm really into these Tuesday night KSJO Love Connection parties. And I really want to go. The guy that's going to be on, that's going to be there tonight really sounds like a babe, and I really want to go meet him. And she said, oh, are you sure you really want to do that? And I said, yeah, I really want to go. She goes, well, you shouldn't go to a bar by yourself. She goes, I'll go with you. Okay. So we go to this bar, and the bouncer asks us for our IDs, and I say, oh, you don't need a card. We're alcoholics. We don't drink. And Marianne, like, elbowed me, and she's like, remember the anonymity thing? You know? Anyway, we stayed there for, like, 10 or 15 minutes, and it was just, the bar scene didn't do it for me if I wasn't drinking, so we left. And, you know, one of the things that I remember when I first got here is that I was so afraid of not being able to drink for the rest of my life. That thought was just, I couldn't fathom it. I couldn't see how I was going to live my life, the whole rest of my life. I mean, I might live until I'm 90 years old. Gosh, that's a long time. And I'm never going to be able to drink again. I was so worried about it, and I thought, you know what, the fun is really over. Okay, you know, for 26 years on this earth, I've had some fun, and now my life is over. I have to be sober. And on the other hand, I was really afraid of what would happen if I started drinking again, because I knew that I had already ended up, you know, with half a car, in jail, you know, I don't think I was ever institutionalized. It could have been in a blackout. I don't remember. But I knew that my drinking had taken me to some depths, and I knew that if I went out and drank again, it could get worse. So I was afraid of ever drinking again, and I was also afraid of never drinking again. And someone told me that's right where you're supposed to be. It's right where you're supposed to be. And I was also very afraid of never having fun anymore. And again, I expressed that fear to my friend Mary Ann. I said, Mary Ann, I just don't know if I can do this. I don't think I'm going to have any fun anymore for the rest of my life. And she said, you know what? You just stick with us. You just stick with us, and you're going to be rocketed. And I was like, okay. So I, you know, heard a few things like get a sponsor, work the steps, get a big book, read the book, code of meetings, don't drink between meetings, which I did. I drank between meetings for 3 weeks. I would go to a noon, a 3:45, a 6 o'clock, and an 8 o'clock meeting, and then I would go home and I would drink. And then I would get up the next morning hungover, and I would go to the noon, the 3:45, the 6 o'clock, the 8 o'clock, and then I would go home and drink. Because it was, you know, I couldn't remember the last time I had ever laid my head down on a pillow sober. So it was very, very scary for me. I didn't know if I could actually just fall asleep. I didn't know what that was like. And I remember one night what happened for me is some people from the programs after the 8 o'clock meeting, they said, hey, let's go to coffee. And I had been asked to coffee after the meetings before, but I always had to go home and drink, so I never went. But this one time I said, yeah, I'll have some coffee. So I went out, and they took me to a coffee shop, and they wouldn't let me leave until like 2:05 a.m. And when they finally let me leave, I realized, oh my gosh, I can't get booze. It's after 2 in the morning. So I went home, And I laid my head on the pillow, and I remember thinking, this is so weird. This is so weird. And the next thing I knew, I woke up and it was morning. I had stayed sober for one day, for 24 hours. And I wanted to come back to SNL and tell everybody, I have 24 hours. I stayed sober last night. I was so excited. But see, you guys all thought I had like 3 weeks. You guys thought I was coming up on my 30-day chip. And so I had to keep that a secret, and I did keep that a secret for a long time. My sobriety date is April 2nd, 1992. And you know, they say that when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, everything is going to change. Everything about you, about your world, about your perceptions, about everything is going to change, except the one thing that never has to change is your sobriety date. You can pick one sobriety date and keep it forever. It never has to change. So I, you know, listened to your suggestions. You told me to get a sponsor, so I got a sponsor. And some of you may know her name is Ramona. And she's this little rah-rah girl, you know, and she has all this kinds of spunk and everything. And I thought, oh, she'd be great. You know, I want what she has, so I'm going to do what she does. And so we started working on the steps. And step one was very easy for me to do. Step one, you know, it was obvious I was powerless over alcohol. And it was very obvious that my life was unmanageable. And I didn't have a problem with that. And as I said earlier, I was excited to be an alcoholic. I had conceded to my innermost self that this is who I was, and this is a good thing. And so step one I had no problem with. When we got to step two, I had some trouble. Because, as I mentioned earlier in my story, I grew up with no God. Well, that's not true. I was looking through some papers, papers that I wrote way back in elementary school. And there were notes to my mom and notes to my dad and little made-up report cards, you know, mom, cooking, B+, you know, sewing, F, you know. You know, I'm just going through different things, you know, as a teaching thing again. Going through different things, and there was I had written the Our Father prayer, Our Father who art in heaven prayer. I had written it down, and I don't know where I'd ever heard it, but it said, Our Father who art in heaven, how do you know my name? So somewhere in my childhood, I thought that there was a God out there that knew my name, that knew who I was. I don't know. It's the weirdest thing. I still have that piece of paper, and it's really kind of cool in retrospect. And so, but I, you know, I didn't have a firm base of religion or anything like that. And actually, I was quite angry with God, because you see, God sent me to jail, and God wrecked my car, and God, you know, made me sleep with Marlone, and you know, so I was, you know, I was not too hip on this God thing. You know, I had one of those gods that, you know, always was followed by damn it, you know, God damn it, you know, that was my conception of God when I got here. So when they told me I had to come to believe in a power greater than myself that would restore me to sanity, I thought, well, Jesus Christ, he's the one that made me insane. This is not going to work. So if there is a God, I'm not sure I can trust this God to turn my will and my life over to. And I remember working with Ramona on this, and Ramona would say, well, you know, Coco, you know, what makes the wind blow? And I'd say, well, the way the cumulus clouds form in the sky, you know, and give her this, you know, bullshit scientific approach. And she said, well, what makes the clouds in the sky? I said, well, the way the atmosphere comes together, you know, the atmospheric pressure. And she goes, well, what makes the atmospheric pressure? I'd say, well, you know, we live in a galaxy. And we kept expanding. And I'm like, okay, the damn black hole, okay? And I really fought her on this, and I wasn't willing. I wasn't willing to believe. And so I fired her. I said, you're not working for me. You don't understand who I am and where I come from, so I'm going to find somebody else. And so I asked my newfound wonderful friend, Mary Ann, to sponsor me. And she said, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll sponsor you, whatever. So we did step one. I did step one with Mary Ann, and then, you know, we started working on step two, and I was like, no, you don't understand, Mary Ann. I am not going to believe. God's the one that made me insane. You went through the whole thing. And she goes, well, tell me this, Coco. Are you willing? I said, willing to do what? She said, willing to believe. Well, maybe. She goes, well, are you willing to believe? And I said, you know what, Mary Ann, you're pushing it. I'm going to find myself another sponsor. Thank you very much. And I fired Mary Ann. I'm sorry, Mary Ann. Please don't take it personally. I know. I'm glad you didn't drink over that. So I got another sponsor. And some of you may know her, too. Her name is Lenore. And at the time, she had about 10 or 12 years sober. And she said, I said, will you sponsor me? And she said, well, you have under a year, right? And I said, oh, yeah, I just have a couple months. And she said, well, you know, you seem very mature, and you seem like you're really willing to work these steps, so, yeah, I'll sponsor you. And I thought, oh, God, you know. Now I've bitten off something I don't know if I can chew. And so she started to take me through the steps, and I was a little bit resistant with her, but I was also sort of, I don't know, intimidated in a way, because she had told me, you know, I think you're really mature and I think you're willing, so I'll work with you. So I was a little intimidated into it, and I also heard a man speaking here, some of you may know him, Craphead, I mean Jim B. And he started talking one night about the old AA waltz, 1-2-3 drink, 1-2-3 drink. And I thought, I do not want to drink. I have stayed sober for 2 months already. I do not want to start over. So I better get on with this. So I just pretended. I acted as if. I became willing to be willing to be willing to believe. And I just pretended. And you know what? It worked. I continued on through my steps. I did my fourth step. And I still, you know, I still was pretending to believe all through my steps. I was just pretending, you know, to turn my life over to God as I understood him. You know, I'd get up in the morning and I had the third step prayer written on an index card, and I would say that prayer in the morning, acting as if I believed it was true. And I did my four-step inventory, and, you know, I had heard things about inventories, and I was a little, you know, nervous about it, but it was actually quite great. Actually, writing the inventory was wonderful because I got to make a list of everyone I was pissed off at and what they did to me. That felt really good. And, you know, and I got to write about some other things, some other experiences that I had that I thought I would never tell anybody. And so I shared my whole life story with Lenore. And we had, you know, we started working together at like 6 in the evening, and by the time I was done, it was about 3 in the morning. And she said, you know, why don't you just stay here tonight? Because, you know, you're exhausted, and you just, you know, I'll just throw out a sleeping bag and you can just crash here. And I said, that's fine. And the only thing that was left, and this is where I learned this, that you're as sick as your secrets. The only thing, even though I had just shared every nook and cranny of my life with her, the only thing that I didn't share with her was the fact that my sobriety date was not really March 12th or whatever. It was really April 2nd. And I thought, you know, if I tell her, she's going to fire me. She's going to make me start over. She's going to deny me entrance into SNL. I mean, my head took this thing really, really far, and but I remember, you know, you're as sick as your secrets, you're as sick as your secrets. I kept hearing that over and over again, and I thought, this is the only secret I have left, and I'm going to tell her. So I went and I knocked on her door, bedroom door, and she said, yeah? And I said, I have one more thing to tell you. And she opens her door, she's like, yeah? She's thinking she's going to get some real dirt, right? Yeah? What is it? I said, you know, my sobriety date is not March, whatever, it's April 2nd. She goes, oh, okay, good night. She shuts the door, and I thought, you bitch. You don't know what I went through. You know, I agonized over whether to share that or not. And so that's why I think it's really important that we share our secrets, because they're really not that big of a deal. you know, our secrets can become really huge in our head. And, you know, I don't know, some people may end up drinking over them, but if you just say it, if you just share it, it, you know, we all think the same. We're all humans. So I did my fourth and fifth step. And six and seven, you know, I thought I didn't have to spend too much time on because, you see, I didn't have very many shortcomings. My character defect list was limited. And so, I noticed also, I thought, well, what a coincidence that in the big book that there's a paragraph on step six, it's like this big, and a paragraph on step seven. So I thought, okay, that's relative to my character defects. Good, okay, that's fine. So I blasted through six and seven, and, you know, what I've come to learn by staying sober a few days is that the longer you stay sober, the more your defects are revealed. You know, God will only reveal to you what you can handle. And as I have stayed sober, there have been some glaring defects and some defects that I continue to work on today. And sometimes those are the hardest steps for me now, is to be able to, you know, ask God to remove those shortcomings, to be entirely ready to have them removed. Often I'm partially ready to have them removed, but rarely am I entirely ready to have them removed. Step eight was somewhat frightening for me. I chose to make my first amends to a friend of mine who I had gone to Club Med with many years before and just made an ass of myself. And I felt I owed her an amends for my behavior, for publicly humiliating her at Club Med. I don't know if you've ever been to Club Med, but once you're there, you can't leave. So it's a little, you know, embarrassing if you've slept with 18 guys in the same club. No. Anyway. Anyway, so I told I owed her an amends, and I chose her because I figured that she was somewhat of a soft person, and that would be okay. So I went to go make my amends to her, and she knew exactly what I was. I'm an Al-Anon. You're doing the right thing. Good for you. You're on step eight. Good. Go for it. And it was a sign. It was like, okay, God. Okay. I'm starting to believe. Starting to believe in little miracles happening. And sometime around my ninth month and my ninth step, I went to a retreat. It was a bunch of us that we went up to Lake Tahoe, to the cabin in Lake Tahoe. And it was wonderful. It was a mix of people from Saturday Night Live, and we went up there for a big ski trip. And I remember we had these meditation sessions, and something happened. I was not trying to make it happen. It just happened. And what that was I was, as you promised, I was rocketed into the fourth dimension. That willingness to believe in a higher power went from my head and dropped right to my heart. And I had a spiritual awakening. I did not see a burning bush, but I did have a huge awakening. And we returned from that trip, and people would say, oh, how you doing, Coco? And I'd say, I'm great, how are you? And they'd say, oh, a little messed up today. And I'd say, well, let go and let God. Live and let live. Turn it over. And they would say, shut up. And I would say, but I've got it now. I get it. And they're like, yeah, sit down and listen to the meeting, you know. But something happened. And I, you know, it was simply because I was willing to be willing to be willing to believe. That's all it was. I was just willing to act as if, to go through the steps and just pretend and to not drink between meetings. And what I get to do today is I get to do steps 10, 11, and 12 on a regular basis. You know, 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps. When I do something that I know is not right, generally I know right away. You know, I have that gut instinct, that I can trust today. You know, I have a higher power that works in my life that lets me know when I'm not behaving appropriately. And I can take that personal inventory pretty much on a moment-by-moment basis and fix it as quickly as I can. You know, I think the first time that I realized that I was doing that consciously, I had done some Christmas shopping at that Home Express store, which is no longer there. I'm very disappointed that they moved that store, or that store went out of business at Westgate. But I did some Christmas shopping there, and I had loaded just tons of stuff in my shopping cart. All these Christmas presents and things for me, and just loaded up. And I got to the checkout stand, and I realized, you know, as the cash register, the dollar amount's ringing higher and higher. I'm thinking, you know, I probably went overboard. So I started taking things out of the cart and setting them way back on the counter. And, you know, and just, you know, put them way over there. And I told the cashier, I don't want these things over here. You know, I've got too much stuff. I just want this stuff over here. And she said, okay, no problem. So she rang me up for the stuff over here. And what happened is some other guy came along and did the bagging. And he bagged everything. And I went home, and I was taking stuff out of the bags, and I was going, oh, thank you, God. You are so wonderful. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too. I was thinking, this is my lucky day. You know, gosh, God, you know, I'm really grateful. And, you know, within 60 seconds, my mind said, take it back. You need to return the merchandise. And I did. You know, I took everything back that I didn't pay for, and I returned it. And the people at Home Express were like, wow, that's really cool. Wow, I would have kept it, you know. And for me, you know, but for me, that was the first time that I realized that I had taken a personal inventory. I had continued to take personal inventory, and when I was wrong, I promptly admitted it. I have to have things happen to me in very concrete ways. Otherwise, I don't learn. And so that was sort of a conscious experience of the personal inventory. And since that time, you know, I've been able to sort of subconsciously take my inventory. And step 11, thought through prayer and meditation. You know, this morning I went for a hike. I often hike up to the top of St. Joseph's Hill up in Los Gatos. And when I get to the top of that hill, the first words out of my mouth are, God, thy will not mine be done. You know, whatever you want me to do today is what I'm going to do. You know, if I'm going to kill Mark H. for making me be the speaker tonight, that's what I'm going to do. If that's your will, God, you know. You know, I'll tell you the funny thing is that, this is a little off track, but I need to share this, because when I come to AA meetings, even though SNL is my home group and I feel very comfortable here, I usually like to hide behind people or behind that brown pole like my friend Mary and Lynn, you're hiding right now, because for some reason, you know, I always think that I'm so great that everyone's going to call on me, right? So I've got to hide so that they don't see that I'm there, so that I won't get called on. And I really enjoy coming to speaker meetings because I know I'm not going to get called on. So, anyway, I don't know. Somehow I'm up here at the speaker meeting and somehow I got called on. But it must be God's will. So, you know, I was sharing at the women's meeting a week or two ago that, you know, meditation, I have a really hard time with meditation. I don't know about any of you, but I cannot sit still for more than about 20 seconds. I cannot be quiet for, you know, 10 seconds. I always have to be doing and going and I'm always, you know, running and thinking things. And so what I do to practice my meditation is I put on a tape. There's this tape that I got from Anonymously Yours called 11 Step Prayer and Meditation Tape. And I put on the tape and I lay down. And usually about 20 minutes into the tape, you know, I'm like, and I shared that, and someone came up to me after the meeting and said, you know what, if that's what's happening, you're doing it right. You're doing it perfectly. You're letting go, and you're letting God, and you're letting those messages come in. I'm like, yeah, you don't realize that I'm dreaming about maple-covered donuts and things. And so The other thing that I get to do is I try to practice the principles that I've learned here in all of my affairs and to carry the message to other alcoholics. And, you know, right now I'm sponsoring a lot of women, and you know, and it feels really good. You know, by me sharing my experience, strength, and hope with a newcomer, you know, maybe that's helping them, I don't know. But you know what? It's helping me. I get to stay sober another day because I've helped another alcoholic. And that's an awesome gift. I've had so many gifts happen for me in this program. At about 2 weeks shy of a year, I asked this guy out in the program. Now, okay, he didn't 13-step me because I asked him out. And I wasn't really a newcomer anymore because I almost had a year. Anyway, the man who I asked out, he's my husband. We've been married for 2 years, over 2 years. And he's here in this room. Now, if you're new, I don't advise you to ask anybody out yet, you know. Wait about a year. You know, wait about a year, because from the time you walk in to a year later, you're going to be a completely different person than who you are right now or who you were when you walked in. I went back to San Jose State University, and I got down off my knees and I begged. This is about 2 years of sobriety. And I said, please, 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 the student has arrived. I'm here to learn. And they maybe jump through about 6 hoops of fire and go up against boards of people and panels of people and interviews and everything. And they said, okay, we'll give you another chance. And a few years after that, I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree in child development. And I continued my education. And just recently, I finished up my teaching credential. And I'm a teacher. So I am 34 years old and I'm still playing school. You know, I don't have to line up my stuffed animals anymore or make my sister Emily sit down and, you know, read the textbook with me. You were such a good sport, Emily. I probably owe you an amends for that. You know, I've had some gifts. And you know, Emily is another gift of this program. Remember when I got married 2 years ago, Emily was at my wedding and she was loaded. She was so out there. And I had never, you know, I know that she looked at me and said, what a huge geek. Look at this broad. She doesn't drink. She doesn't smoke pot. She doesn't do dope. She doesn't do coke. You know, what a straight, narrow ass. You know? And I looked at her and thought, please, God, please help keep her alive, you know. And it wasn't long after my wedding that she came to me, and I never talked to her about AA, never, you know, tried to convince her to come in. You know, I was taught that this program is a program of attraction, not promotion. We don't go out and promote it and try and pull people in here. People will come. When the student is ready, the teacher will come. And Emily came to me shortly after our wedding, and she said, I think I want what you have. And, you know, she has a year and some odd months of sobriety today. You know, there's no greater gift than having a family member come in, you know, do the deal and stay sober. I mean, that's the biggest gift of all. We have other family members that are still out there in the disease, and we can only lead by example. And so I have to remember that no matter where I am a walking example of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And shockingly to me, the whole purpose of the book, wherever it is, that's okay. The whole purpose of this book, it says, and this shocked the heck out of me. Some of you probably already know this by heart, but I still have to look things up. That's okay. It says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That's the main purpose of this book. And you know what? I didn't know that until maybe a year ago. You know, like they say, more will be revealed. Anyway, I am just so relieved that I did not choke nor crap my pants. And I just want to thank each and every one of you for letting me share tonight. And if you're new and you're not sure that you can relate to anything that I said, or you're not impressed at all, I encourage you to come back to another meeting. Because sometime, somewhere, you'll hear your story, and you too can have that relief of knowing that one day at a time, you never, ever have to drink again. Thanks.